greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Kwok-Ting test when we come back. You know, those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm, but submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people, and the Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press, of political and social activities, free from government surveillance. Now, you know, I wished I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes and our politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control. But you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. That's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts. It doesn't come from our political process. It certainly doesn't come from our politicians, our lawyers, or our bureaucrats. Old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, I could reiterate that by saying, "You give me the judicial power, and I care not who makes the laws either," because the real power in America is in our courts. It's not in our politics. Now, if you'd like to learn how to tap into that power of the courts, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's the place to start. It's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. Best of all, it's free. And courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc. That's our school. And it's great for home education. And if you're online, you can just go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. It's an easy one, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and then send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we're talking about the Kwok-Ting test. Now, what this is, it's a Supreme Court modality for determining the truth. Yeah, for determining the truth. There's a test that our judiciary uses to establish whether or not you're telling the truth or lying. It's a three-part test. Three-part test. Here's what it is. The testimony that you give has to be complete. That's number one. So they're looking for complete testimony, a whole story. Number two, they're looking for testimony that must contain extemporaneous detail. There's got to be details concerned with this story or connected with this story. And then the testimony has to be supported by witnesses or evidence. And that's because parole evidence, that is, testimonial evidence, is notoriously, It is scandalously incomplete. It is in error. It is phony. It is to be distrusted. Eyewitness testimony is the least reliable evidence that you can introduce in court. Let me repeat that. Eyewitness testimony is the least reliable that you can introduce in court. And it always has to be tested. It's always suspect. Now, when the police come in with a forensic test, assuming that the testimony concerning the forensic test is true, accurate, and correct, which it may not be, But you know, there's an old adage that says, you know, liars figure, but figures don't lie. Now, when the FBI does a test on a gun, and they say, this bullet came from that gun, and this bullet came from this other gun, and this bullet didn't come from this gun, and that bullet didn't come from this gun, but here are the guns that these bullets came from, those are scientific tests. They fire a bullet out of a gun, and they compare it with another bullet fired from the same gun, and it's got rifling marks on it. And those marks will be the same from bullet to bullet to bullet. And as they look at that under the microscope, they can see that these little telltale ridges or scratches in the bullet match the bullets that are fired from another gun, fingerprints or another source of hard evidence that this fingerprint that we got off that windowsill fits the fingerprint of the defendant over there. So we can place him at the scene because his fingerprint is there. Now, those are exhibits. Those are hard pieces of evidence that we can use that are reliable. Now, when somebody testifies to a particular fact, somebody comes in and says, well, that's the guy that raped me. Well, that statement may be true or it may not. Now, yesterday I gave you an example of a story. The Earl Sherman story, I call it. It's a real story. It's an event that transpired in my life. And had I been called to court to testify, I would have testified that the Delta driver struck our automobile. But it was a lie. It wasn't true. The Delta truck did not strike our car, even though I believed at the time I was an eyewitness. If you'd have asked me, Mr. Gordon, were you an eyewitness? Yes. Was the driver, Earl Sherman, was he an eyewitness? Yes. Because I really didn't know what the hell an eyewitness was. I thought that the eyewitness was the guy that was there and could testify to the facts and that was an integral part of the transaction. Now, oftentimes people are integral. They are a vital part of the witnesses who saw a transaction, but they're not necessarily eyewitnesses. Sometimes you hear something, you're a hearing witness, or you might feel something, you could be a feeling witness, but that doesn't mean that you saw anything. What if a blind person had been sitting in the seat? Would you have called him an eyewitness? Well, if I would have been stone cold blind, I wouldn't have seen any more than I saw that day riding in the automobile. Now, the Delta driver was an eyewitness. Now, if you'll remember, the Delta truck was right behind our car, and I gave you a hypothetical cross-examination in which the Delta driver would impeach my testimony and the testimony of Earl Sherman in that we called ourselves eyewitnesses. And that would be fairly simple, you know, to impeach that testimony. Now, once he has impeached our testimony concerning our eyewitness observation of the transaction, there was actually some hard physical evidence there. For instance, here we are in front of the David Gray furniture store. After we had taken the tube off ramp, we're sitting here parked alongside the curb, and the Delta driver then said, look at the damage to your car. And so Mr. Sherman and I, now highly charged, very emotional, very excited, both of us were, because this Delta driver didn't stop. He just kept on going. And then when we did stop him and we did engage him in conversation, he made a flat denial that he struck our car. And we both believed that he did, in the same way that the two clerks believed that they saw blood everywhere. They didn't see any blood. They believe it. They'll believe it until they die. But they didn't see any blood there. There wasn't any. So the Delta driver, after calling our attention now to the damage to our car, he said, do you see the red paint there? And it was the first revelation to us that there was red paint on the damaged area to Mr. Sherman's car. And we said, well, yeah, we see the red paint. He said, now look at the bumper on my truck. The bumper is black. There is no red paint there. And we looked at the bumper on the Delta truck. Now, Delta trucks were painted yellow and black. They're a yellow truck with black trim. The bumper was painted black. We looked at the red paint on the damaged area. We looked at the bumper. And we looked back at the red paint. And we looked back at the bumper. And we were dumbfounded. We didn't know what that meant. So the Delta driver said, look at my bumper. Notice there are no scratches on the bumper. We looked at the bumper, and there were no scratches on it. Now, obviously, had the Delta truck struck our automobile, there would have been scratches on the bumper. Perhaps it would have been bent. This was a brand new Delta truck. It probably hadn't been in service for a month. And there were no scratches on the bumper. And there would have had to have been scratches on the bumper had he struck our car. Furthermore, there was red paint, but there was no black paint on the damaged area. No black paint. It was all red. Now, the both of us are standing there absolutely amazed. And the Delta driver said, now, I was an eyewitness, and here's what I saw. He said he was following a green and red ONC truck directly in front of him. When traffic slowed suddenly, he slammed on his brakes, and he observed the green and red ONC truck swerve to the right to avoid striking our car. He didn't quite make the maneuver in time. And as he was making the maneuver, changing from the fourth lane to the third lane, he just clipped the right rear corner of our truck, which gave an extra 50 or 60 feet for the Delta truck to stop without striking our car. He stopped just inches from our bumper, and we had stopped just inches from the bumper of the car ahead of us. Had the ONC driver not changed lanes, he then would have struck our car, driving our car into the one ahead, and the one ahead, there would have been a hell of a pileup. So the ONC driver, actually, with the presence of mind, looking ahead and saying, no way am I going to get stopped, immediately change lanes. There happened to be room for him to change lanes. Now, remember, the Delta driver would have asked the question, Mr. Gordon, could it have been 1 second after you stopped that you felt the impact? And I said, I would have said, yes, it could have been a second, because, boys and girls, we were actually stopped. When I felt the impact, turned around, looked through the window, and saw the Delta truck. Now, how long does it take you to register, your mind to register this impact and then turn around? Well, it would have been a second or two, which is exactly right. That's about how much time that it took me to turn around to see the Delta truck behind our car. So close, in fact, that I couldn't see his bumper over the deck lid of the trunk. Nor could I see the bumper of the car in front of us over the hood of our car. That's how close we were, but we didn't touch. We didn't hit him. And the Delta truck didn't hit our car either. Now, once we looked at the damage, and once we looked at the color of the paint, and we looked at the black bumper, which had no scratches on it, it dawned on us as to what had happened when he explained it to us. See, it was a mystery when we looked at the evidence. It wasn't a mystery after he told us. Now, this is the value of witnesses. A witness should testify to what he knows, what he heard, and what he saw. not to a conclusion that it must have been the Delta truck that struck us because it's the only truck that I can see. You see, I drew a conclusion. When I looked through the back window, I saw a yellow and black truck with Delta written on it. And since we had just been struck, I drew the conclusion, well, it had to be that truck. There wasn't any other answer. Oh, no. There wasn't any answer from my perspective as a witness. Not as an eyewitness, but as a witness. From my perspective, from where I was sitting, from what I could see, from what I could feel, from what I could know. That was my conclusion. And this is why in court, that draws a conclusion is a proper objection. And the lawyer will say, objection. He's drawing a conclusion. And over the years, we've come to a conclusion that is in the judicial arena that eyewitness testimony is unreliable. It has to be tested. Now, what people see is important. What they feel, what they hear, all of that is important, but it's not necessarily conclusive. Now, when a witness, such as a rape victim who has been highly traumatized, remember we talked about this last time, 30% of rape convictions in the United States, we know this now from DNA testing, we know that 30% of the people that are locked up in prison, accused of rape, are actually innocent. Well then, why is it that in every rape case it requires the victim to positively identify the rapist? Well, here's what happens. A rape occurs, and a woman goes to the hospital. The police come to the hospital, and sure enough, the doctor confirms, yep, this woman's been raped. All right. She says she's been raped, and the doctors and the medical personnel, they say, yep, she's been raped. Now, they take it a step further, and they say to this woman, well, can you give us a description of the rapist? Now, typically, this has occurred at night. Maybe she can identify the rapist by race. Maybe she can say he was Hispanic, he was white, he was black, he was Oriental. Maybe. Maybe not. And so the police then, based upon whatever information she gives them, they go out and they start looking for rapists. And typically they will start looking for rapists that they know about. And they'll go out and they'll pick up five or six rapists that are probably within the geographical location of the place that this rape took place, and they bring them into a lineup. And this woman, maybe you know it's dark, it's night, and maybe she recognizes some physical description. I showed you from Professor Swift the last time. I said, look, 25% of everything that comes out of your mouth is not true. I know that's shocking, but I'm going to tell you again. 25% of what comes out of your mouth is false. You believe it's true. Just like those two clerks, they believed there was blood everywhere, but I'm here to tell you that I was the victim involved, and I can tell you there wasn't any blood. I testified to those facts. I testified that there wasn't any blood. My wife testified that there wasn't any blood. She didn't see any blood. She deliberately planted in their minds that suggestion, and that's what the police do. They deliberately plant in the mind of the victim that that's the rapist. Now, here's the way this works. The police, now under pressure to produce the criminal, they put the lineup together, and they've got five or six rapists over here that have been convicted in the past of rape. And so they say to the woman, well, pick him out. Now, this woman can't pick him out. I one time was faced with the lineup, and my wife was trying to pick out a detective that she saw. But she could not, because of the trauma. She had been traumatized in the jail. She could not pick out the detective who came in and who was the duty officer at the time out of a lineup. Now, fortunately, my wife, instead of guessing, said, I can't recognize anybody. And that's because when you're excited, your adrenaline is flowing, your brain turns off. When you're excited and the adrenaline's flowing, your brain shuts off. It doesn't work like it does under ordinary circumstances. In fact, your brain does not register everything that your eyes see anyway. And I'll show you that as we progress along and show you why this Kwok Ting test is so important in testing witnesses, and cross-examination is so important when we examine witnesses. The witness may actually believe what he's testifying to. He's not lying on purpose. He doesn't have any malign intent to deceive. But that's precisely what he's doing. And that's what women do 30% of the time when they're identifying the rapist. And so the police now, they say, well, based upon what you told us, she looks at these five or six guys in the lineup. She says, I can't identify him. Now, the policeman then identifies the guy for her. And he says, we think it's number three. Take a good look at number three again. Because we think it's number three. And here's why we think it's number three. Now she takes a new look. And based upon the suggestions that the police are now giving her. Remember, you said that he was medium height, medium build. Well, this guy is medium height and medium build. Okay, he may be the only guy there in the lineup that is medium height, medium build, but that doesn't mean that he's the rapist. A lot of people are medium height and medium build. You say he was wearing dark clothing. This guy is wearing dark clothing, and the other guys are wearing light clothing. That may all well be true, but we don't know that this guy that raped you, lady, is a former rapist. Which is the only rapist that we know about, or former rapist. Every rapist had to have raped his first woman, and maybe this is a first time. You know, there are a lot of factors that go into this identification. And so now the police, based upon what this woman has said that she could remember, they produce a witness. They've got a victim. They've got a defendant. They've got a guy. And that's the guy we think it is. And if she still is recalcitrant and says, well, I'm not sure I can identify him, they say, look, do you want one of these guilty rapists to go free? To just roam around on the streets raping other women like he raped you? And of course the answer is, well, no, I don't. Do you want to file a false police report? Do you want us to prosecute you, lady, for filing a false police report? And she'd say, well, no, I don't want to go to jail because I filed a false police report. Well, then you better identify that number three. And you're sitting there saying, well, surely the police wouldn't do that. Oh, hell, the police do it every day. Hell, you just saw it at Duke University. The police falsely accused five rugby players. They knew that they hadn't raped those women. And they went ahead with the prosecution for about a year and a half. Now, that's a very high-profile case that came to light. 99% of the time, it doesn't come to light. We don't always have the videotape of a Rodney King beating. Do the police beat prisoners every day? Is it common? It's as common as pig tracks in a barnyard. Wake up, smell the coffee. But now, you and I, as witnesses, like I described with the Earl Sherman story, as just an average Joe Sixpack, I would have hung that Delta driver. I'd have put him in prison because I was emotionally charged. Fortunately, we do have a process whereby we can eliminate those kinds of mistakes if we use the tools that are available to us. If prosecutors and policemen use the tools that are available, many times guilty people will go free, but we will eliminate locking up innocent people. And after all, that's the principle of justice that we Americans have lived under for 200 years. Our principle of justice was that we believed that it would be better to turn a guilty man loose than to lock up or to punish an innocent man. Now, we don't follow that any longer. And that's because we no longer use a justice system that we got from Moses in the Bible. Instead, we now use the adversarial system. It's a contest. My job as a prosecutor is to convict you. The police, their job is to find somebody to prosecute. So they go out and they find somebody to prosecute. Now, it is true, most of the time, that when the police arrest 5 or 10 guys, put them in a lineup, these guys are all former rapists. And they've probably been convicted and served time for rape. And they probably, you know, all things being equal, they probably ought to go to jail again 3 more times for the last rape that they committed. I don't deny that. But nevertheless, the guy didn't commit this rape. And, you know, he's already paid his price for the last rape. You know, he paid his price in prison. That's what the law calls for. And so, you know, if the guy didn't do this rape, he ought not to be punished for it, should he? I mean, just mull that one over for a minute. And so the police now under pressure to produce a defendant, and the victim now under pressure by the police to produce a defendant, they go to work with the power of suggestion. That's precisely what Professor Swift determined, that oftentimes suggestion, one of the bizarre things that came out of Professor Swift's original studies was that one of the witnesses said that he saw that the shot was fired with a .32 revolver. Excuse me. The story was this. The guy comes in flourishing a banana. He hears a shot. He smells the gun smoke. And he comes back and testifies that it was a .32 revolver. It wasn't a .32 revolver. It was a banana. But he says, I can't testify that I saw this guy shot with a banana. Boys and girls, that's precisely what he saw. And that's precisely what he should testify to. And he would be asked, do you expect us to believe that this man was shot with a banana? Yes, sir, because that's what I saw. That's what I heard. That's what I smelled. And that's what I know. I saw that guy shot with a banana. Now, did he see the whole story? He didn't see the torpedo being thrown. He didn't see a .32 revolver. He did not see a Smith & Wesson revolver. But that's what he testified to. That was written in his report. But that is not what he saw. What he actually saw was a man who was shot. He smelled gun smoke. He should testify to that. I smelled gun smoke. Do you recognize the smell of gun smoke? Yes. How do you recognize the smell of gun smoke? Because I have fired guns many times and smelled the smoke. And I recognize the smell of the cordite in the gun smoke. And that's what I smelled in the classroom that day. All right. What kind of a weapon did you see? Well, I saw this man holding a banana. And you heard the shot. I did. And you saw the man fall back. I did. And he cried out, I have been shot. Yes. All right. So you saw him shot with a banana. That's what I saw. Now leave it up to some other witness to come forward and say, well, you know, it really wasn't a shot with a banana. Actually, it was a torpedo, and Professor Swift would testify, yes, I actually made up this entire scene. It was made to order to demonstrate psychologically to people that their testimony would be false or would tend to be false unless they were very, very careful to testify to just what they saw, just what they heard, and just what they know. I threw a torpedo. The torpedo went bang. It sounded about like a .32 revolver being discharged. Now, the man who testified that it was a .32 revolver probably had been out with his uncle at some point in his life, and they were firing a .32 Smith & Wesson revolver. When he heard the sound of the torpedo, it was probably about the size or the sound of a .32 revolver that he could remember. He smelled the gun smoke. and it recollected. The power of suggestion recollected to him that it was a 32. After all, his conclusion was, who would believe me if I told them that I saw him shot with a banana? So he drew a conclusion. His conclusion was, it couldn't have been the banana, but it could have been the 32 Smith & Wesson revolver that I remember as a child, my uncle taking me out and we fired it at targets. The power of suggestion caused him to testify to that falsehood. In the same way that the power of suggestion from my wife caused those two court reporters to testify to a falsehood that they saw blood everywhere. They didn't see any blood, it wasn't there. And he didn't see a Smith & Wesson because it wasn't there. And that's the fallacy of testimony. It's the fallacy of the eyewitness. Hey, hang on, we got to take a break here and remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. And if you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Remember, The Law School teaches 8 schools: family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And if you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. On the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now remember, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Now the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements are recommendations that we give. Do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend will necessarily reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour are political, or they may be religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the Kwok Ting test, which really deals with evidence that is delivered by witnesses. Typically, they call themselves eyewitnesses. I'm an eyewitness to this. And I told you about the Earl Sherman story in which I thought I was an eyewitness, but I really wasn't. Then we covered the Professor Swift story, in which Professor Swift first tested this. Now, let me give you an illustration about how this works psychologically. Today, the test that I saw was done with two video cameras at right angles to one another, set up at a picnic in which two couples with two children each were having a picnic. And it was a typical 4th of July type of scene where there's a dock and these people are going out on the dock and going water skiing. And they have a barbecue, or not a barbecue, they're actually using charcoal, I guess it is a barbecue, cooking hamburgers and hot dogs, and they're having a good time. And this goes on for about an hour. The film is about 1 hour long. And then you've actually been here seeing this. Now, I saw it in the form of a film as an instruction film, but the people that were actually a part of this were sitting on the shore on picnic benches. And they were instructed to physically watch and take notes of the events that were watching. But they did not know that there were two hidden video cameras photographing this whole thing. They thought that they were just witnesses and that they were taking notes for the express purpose of later coming back and testifying or giving a deposition as to what they saw. So they sat there and they took notes, and of course now here's another video camera that's off camera, which is taking pictures of not the picnic itself, but rather of the witnesses to the picnic. So what I'm watching is the behind the scenes candid camera taking the pictures of the witnesses who are really the subject of this entire event, not the picnickers, who the witnesses believe are the subjects of this entire event. Actually, the witnesses are the subject. And so they're watching this event transpire. And so the boat leaves the dock and somebody's water skiing, and they're free to take all of these notes. Goes on for about an hour. Now, when this is over, they're given a test. They're asked 100 questions concerning this event that has transpired. You know, questions like, what color was the boat? What was the brand of boat? Did the boat have an inboard or an outboard motor? If it was an outboard motor, what was the brand of motor? Was it an Evinrude? Was it a Yamaha? And so on. How many people were present at the picnic? How many adults? How many children? How many males? How many females? Did they use a slalom ski? And on it goes. And so they're asking these 100 questions. And so the eyewitnesses, just like in Professor Swift's test, are answering all these questions. And when they get through with all of the answers, they turn in their papers, and then their papers are graded. Now here's what they discover. Immediately after an event transpires, 25% of your questions will be answered falsely. That's right, 25%. Now that's immediately after. Now also, they will come back 6 months and 1 year after this event transpires, give you exactly the same questions, the same test. And 6 months later, 50% of your answers will be false. And 1 year later, 50% of your answers will be false. So as time progresses, the answers that you give will tend to false memory more readily as more time passes. But for the first 6 months, compared to 1 year, it's about 50%. But immediately after the event transpires, your memory is false to the extent of 25%. Now, you would believe that, or you would think that, immediately after the transaction, I could remember what had happened. Now, you want to remember that when a policeman stops you on the highway, let's think about this event. You've seen it happen many times. The policeman stops you, gives you a ticket. Then after you've got your ticket, the policeman goes back to his car. He gets into his car, you start your car, and you drive down the road. You look in your rearview mirror, and here's the policeman. He's still stopped along the road. You drive down the road a mile. He's still stopped alongside the road. And then as you're driving down the road, he finally just disappears in the rearview mirror. Have you ever asked yourself, what is the policeman doing? How come he doesn't start his car and follow you down the road or pass you or do something else or turn around, go the other way? Or does he just stop and wait because he doesn't want to get too close behind you? Or what's the purpose for, what is he doing back there? Have you ever wondered about that? Well, here's what the policeman's doing. He is writing up a detailed report as best as he can remember of the events that just transpired leading up to and the giving of the ticket and what he did after that. He's writing a report. And he does that because you may go into court and plead not guilty. And this case may have to go to trial. And if it does, the trial may be a month or 2 months or 6 months down the road. Or a year or two. And when he comes back in to testify, he's going to refresh his recollection. Well, you know, if he's asked the question, was it raining or was it dry that night? How can he remember 6 months ago giving a ticket to you, whether it was raining or not? I mean, this guy gives out hundreds of tickets. And he gives out tickets every day. He works 5 days a week, 8 hours a day, sometimes overtime. And he's writing tickets all the time. Sometimes it's raining, sometimes it isn't. How could he possibly remember? And the answer is he can't. So he writes it down. It's just part and parcel of his training. It's a part and parcel of his job description. And so he writes down the events. He'll say this event transpired at or approximately milepost 381 on Highway 60. And it was on Wednesday at 7:32 p.m. I observed an automobile, a green and white Chevrolet Camaro, traveling westbound approximately 60 miles an hour. And so he makes these descriptions. He makes these observations. But now here's the important thing. 25% of everything in that report is false. Did you know that? That's right. See, that policeman is not Superman, and his brain works just like yours, just like mine. And so when he makes observations, he's just as susceptible to drawing a conclusion or coming to the conclusion, oh my God, look at the blood, as you or I or anybody else. All of us have the same disabilities. This is why God has instructed us not to take an oath. And he said, you shall not swear. Why is that? Because what you're swearing to, 25% is false. It's perjury. It's a lie. It ain't so. So God instead said, well, let your yea be yea and your nay be nay, because whatsoever comes more than that comes of evil. It's evil for you to point at some guy and say, that's the rapist. Now, if you can recognize him and you know that that's the rapist, you should point at him and say, that's the guy right there, I recognize him. And I specifically recognize that tattoo of an eagle on his arm. Well, now, how many guys have an eagle on their arm? How many guys have the specific identifying characteristics that you can remember in your brain? I'm not suggesting, you know, that every rape, the bright spot is 70% of the rapists that are in prison belong there because they've been properly identified. But we're not talking about that 70% that are properly identified. We're talking about the 30% that have been improperly identified, the 30% who are innocent, who have been locked up and they ought not to be. And the witnesses against them perjured themselves. They lied about the guy. And now he's suffering because of your false testimony. And so the judicial process is aimed at, it's designed to weed out, to eliminate this. But it's an adversarial system, and it's up to you to come in and do the cross-examination. Now, remember I used the analogy and I said, well, the Delta driver, if he were acting pro se, could have asked me these questions and impeached my testimony. But typically, he doesn't do that. He hires a lawyer. In other words, he's going to hire somebody to come in and conduct this cross-examination who was not present, does not know anything about this accident, didn't see anything. He wasn't a witness. And that's why a pro se litigant is actually the best lawyer to represent you in this case, because you were actually there. And when somebody lies, you will recognize that that wasn't true, because that isn't what happened. Now, one of the things that you can do when events transpire is do like the policeman does. Stop, sit down, and write up a report. The policeman's report is as accurate as any report that you can get, because it happened exactly at the time of the event, when his mind is the freshest. If you wait until the next day, or 2 days, or 3 days later, you've already forgot a lot of essential events. And I'm telling you that at the very time the event transpires, you can be taking notes as you're watching the event, and 25% of it will be inaccurate. Now, you're not lying on purpose. You're actually telling the truth as best you can remember. And that's the Achilles heel. That's as best you can remember. And your memory is faulty. Now, you may sit there and say, oh, my memory isn't faulty. I've got a good memory. Probably your memory is good. But if you've got the best memory that God put into you, it's still 25% inaccurate. And it's designed that way. And you can say, well, God made a mistake, or you didn't evolve to the same level as some other people. Well, I don't know. Maybe that's true. But we can observe, we can test, and when somebody is tested, and here's what happens psychologically. After you have done the test, and you have passed in your questions, and 25% of them are inaccurate, you will become very indignant. And when it's pointed out to you that your answers are true, accurate, and correct because you were actually taking these notes at the time this event transpired. Remember, the witnesses, they believe that the test is to test their memory concerning the picnic and the events of the characters who are out here, having the picnic and doing the water skiing and so on. That's not the objective here at all. That's the witnesses who are the objective. And when these witnesses are confronted with the fact that 25% of their answers are false, they immediately become indignant. And they deny it. And they say, I was an eyewitness. I saw what I saw, and I wrote down what I saw. And then when they're confronted with the actual videotapes, for instance, they may say, well, the boat was blue. When in fact, the boat wasn't blue, it was black. And they may say, well, it was a Yamaha 65. When in fact, the boat was an inboard motor, and it was a Chevy 327, maybe. And they will say, well, those tapes are phonied up because I know what I saw. Just like the two court reporters are going to testify, I saw blood there. Now, boys and girls, I was the victim, and I'm here to tell you there wasn't any blood. If I could have produced blood, you can rest assured I would have done it. Now, Bill John was a bad actor and a bad character, and the sheriff's deputies were certainly acting improperly, and they ought not to have been beating me up. Then it's against the law for them to beat up on their prisoners and to force them into confessions and to force them into fingerprinting. But it happens. And, of course, they're not going to admit it. They're going to deny it. They're going to lie about their actions. When people commit acts that they know are wrong, they naturally deny it. They lie about it. It's just part and parcel with human nature. Now, my point is that even when you're trying to tell the truth, you will be relating false information 25% of the time. And then when you're confronted with it, you will deny it. You go into denial. I know what I saw. Now, the purpose for this series of programs is to bring you up to speed so that you can understand how your brain works, how the policeman's brain works, how the judge's brain works, the prosecutor, and all of the witnesses. They're all coming in and they're all telling stories. And some of what they're telling is the truth, some of what they're telling is false. And in order to arrive at the truth, we have to use what we call the Kwok-Ting test in order to come to a conclusion based upon science now, based upon what we can observe and what we really know. Because what we see on the videotape is what really happened. I mean, that is an outboard or it's an inboard. The boat is either black or it's blue. I mean, it isn't black for one witness and blue for another witness. What color was the boat? Now, unless you are specifically trained as an observer, you probably won't notice. You'll see that the boat is dark. You may even recognize that it's blue. But when you're asked the question after the fact, the boat's gone. When the test is given, the boat isn't there. You have to rely upon your memory. And you remember that it's dark. So if it's dark, then you remember boats that you've seen in the past that you can remember the color. Like maybe, I used to have a boat one time. It was a Dorset. And it was dark. It was black, in fact. So I might, in my mind, remember my black Dorset ski boat. And when asked the question, well, I remember it was dark, and I might draw the conclusion that, therefore, since it was dark, it must have been black. But I didn't really make a mental observation that it was dark blue. Although, had I put my mind to it, I probably could have remembered that. So, oftentimes when events transpire, especially when your adrenaline starts to flow, and this is what Professor Swift so aptly pointed out, that this is a total surprise to the 29 students that are inside. It's not a surprise to Professor Swift. In fact, it was made to order. He was part of the test. He's the guy that threw the torpedo on the floor, remember? He's the guy that created the gun smoke. Now, the witness, he observes, he sees, but in the excitement, he isn't really taking cognizance of what he's seeing, as is evidenced by the fact that many students could not remember how many there were or who they were. They met them all. They knew all of these characters by name. They met them 3 times a week. I mean, you know, you went to school and you recognized, you knew David Wagner. You knew Ed O'Neill. And yet, here you are in an exciting situation in which these very people that you know come into the room, and yet you've got to identify 4 of them, and you can identify 3 out of the 4, or 2 out of the 4, or 1 out of the 4, or in the case of some witnesses, they couldn't recognize any of the 4, depending upon their position in the room, their observations, and their perceptions. All right, so we have to have a standard that we can all rely upon. And the standard is reported in The Art of Cross-Examination by Wellman. So it's time now to take down this book, very important book. All lawyers in America are trained out of Wellman on cross-examination, first written back about 1902. And we'll take a look at some examples because there are 23 ways, 23 tests, 23 modalities that we can employ to impeach the testimony of a false witness. Now you want to remember that the testimony that you give is 25% false. And the same modality or the same test is going to be applied to you to impeach your testimony as you're going to use to impeach the testimony of somebody else. So anytime that we want to impeach somebody's testimony, there's the Kwok-Ting test that we're going to apply. Then I'll show you how to do that as we progress along. So by relating to you the Earl Sherman story, the Professor Swift story, the 30% rape story, and then the power of suggestion, the Bill John, there's blood everywhere story. 4 stories of actual events that transpired. Actual people who are locked up in prison falsely. The real world, the way it really is. But when the witnesses come in to testify, 25%. And it can be more, because oftentimes people will come in with the premeditated determination to deceive. They're actually lying. They're actually committing perjury. They have an agenda. They're doing it deliberately, intentionally. Now here's a rule to remember. The worst thing that can happen to you is that your opponents tell the truth about you. That's the worst thing that can happen. You see, there's no defense against the truth. You see, the truth was the Delta truck did not strike our car. And the worst thing that the Delta driver did to our testimony was to tell the truth about us. Now, the best thing that can happen to you is that your opponent comes in and lies about you. Because if your opponent comes in and lies about you, we have 23 vehicles by which we can impeach his testimony and we can show that he's lying by using this Kwok Ting test. So if you come in and you lie about me, I'm going to have you for lunch. And that's what happened to Mark Furman when he came in and lied in the O.J. Simpson case. Do you remember that? When F. Lee Bailey came in and asked him about the N-word and asked him if he had used the N-word in the locker room. And Furman said, no, I'm not a racist. I don't use the N-word. And when somebody says they don't use the N-word, they don't tell racist jokes, they're lying. We all do. You have, I have, and if a guy came in and said that he hadn't, his testimony would be suspect immediately. Furman should have said, well, of course, in the locker room we tell Polish jokes and German jokes and Jewish jokes, and yeah, we use the N-word jokes too. All right, but he lied, and he was exposed as telling a lie. Because within the last 10 years, they produced the videotapes of his school back in North Carolina, or where he'd gone to school, and where he had used the N-word, and done it within 10 years, which was totally collateral, had nothing to do with the O.J. Simpson case, but it had to do with his credibility and what he was testifying to. Here was a policeman who came in and said, I don't use the N-word, and I'm not a racist, and I don't tell racist jokes, but he lied. And that lie was exposed. And here again, it illustrates my point. The best thing that can happen to you is that the policeman comes in and lies about you. Because we can expose that. The worst thing that can happen to you is the policeman comes in and he tells the truth about you. Because if he's telling the truth, you're not going to impeach his testimony. You can't impeach the truth. You can impeach the lie. So that's the bottom line to the Kwok Ting test. We can actually overcome the liars. We can't overcome the truth tellers. Hey, I'm out of time again here, kids. We're going to have to leave it right there. So let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. And if you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.